If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast, fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. What exactly was the black goo that coated ancient Egyptian mummies? Is it really true that ancient cat mummies fertilised the fields of Victorian England? And before they became shuffling zombified monsters, why were ancient mummies considered sexy? Well, today we've got a special edition of our Everything You Wanted to Know series to answer all of these questions, hosted by the public historian Greg Jenner, who many of you will know from the BBC podcast You're Dead to Me. Recorded behind the scenes at Manchester Museum's Golden Mummies of Egypt exhibition, today's episode delves into the curious world of Egyptian mummification. Joining Greg is Dr. Campbell Price, curator of Egypt and Sudan at the Manchester Museum, and co-author with Greg of a brand new kids' book, Totally Chaotic History, Ancient Egypt Gets Unruly. So without any further ado, over to Greg.
Hello, I'm Greg Jenner. I'm a public historian, and I'm delighted to say I have co-written a book with an Egyptologist, not just any Egyptologist, the best one I know, Dr. Campbell Price. I'm sitting in your lovely room, Campbell. Hello.
Hello, Greg. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. We've spent all day talking about our book. Yes. And now we're going to talk about something that is adjacently related to our book, because our book's called Totally Chaotic History, Ancient Egypt Gets Unruly. But there is a section in there about mummies.
There is,
and we've
Greg.
Had a lot of questions from people all over the place on all the social media apps and all the other technologies, asking loads of stuff about mummies, mummification, the history of it, the technology of it, the culture of it. This is something you know a lot about, and something I know less about.
So for me, as a curator in Manchester Museum, with a collection of 18 complete human mummified bodies,
yeah,
it is something I get asked a lot about. You ask a room full of kids, what's the first thing you know about ancient Egypt? The first hand today was mummies.
Yeah, it was.
And I think it comes from a place of genuine curiosity, and maybe we'll cover some of these issues and the questions, but it's the fact that mummies are kind of universal. And I think death may not be talked about much, yeah, but mummies are something everyone, if you say Egyptian mummy, you've got a mental image.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And it's probably the way through which most of us get into Egyptology as a kid.
It happened to me, Greg. Yeah. Mummified body in the Kelvin Grove Art Gallery and Museum in my native Glasgow. And there was something about that encounter. Actually, it was a sense of disappointment that the mummified body didn't look like the baddie in Thundercats. Mumra, who had a red cape and bright white, like, Vanish-style bandages. And that really disappointed me. And so I'm genuinely believing that that was the moment that set me on the path to Egyptology, encountering a mummy.
Which is interesting. I mean, the first question I've got here is from Instagram. I think the person's called Trace CA. I'm not sure. Apologies if I got your name wrong. But the question was, why are we so obsessed with mummies? You sort of answered it already there. Mm. But from a cultural point of view, they come into our culture in a variety of ways because we see them in museums, such as here in Manchester. Yeah. We see them on TV in documentaries. We also get them in Hollywood movies. Mm-hmm. And in Scooby-Doo episodes, and in gothic literature. And there's a sort of horror and an allure. So I feel that they're everywhere because they've got different, they're doing different things.
You've just hit the nail on the head there, Greg. In another book I've written to accompany an exhibition we had at Manchester Museum, Golden Mummies of Egypt, the last chapter is entitled Between Rapture and Revulsion. We are at once obsessed with this mysterious, alluring, absolutely, as you said, object of desire, but at the same time we're repulsed and offended by the fact that in modern society you don't tend to engage much with human corpses. So it's that mixture, it's the taboo. There's something also about the status of the mummified dead that's unreal and uncanny. Mm-hmm. So when you come to a museum like this, kids come in, and exactly as you said, Greg, they have seen mummies in horror movies or cartoons, and they're featured alongside vampires and werewolves and the creature from the Black Lagoon, and you're told those things aren't real. So what do you do when your parents say, oh, but there's really an Egyptian mummy?
Yeah.
So they exist in this uncanny realm that makes them all the more attractive.
Yeah, you're right. And my four-year-old daughter has started asking questions about death, which four-year-olds do. And she saw a book that she saw the book that we wrote, actually, and she saw a little page with mummies on it. And she immediately went, mummy. And I went, how do you know that? So it was kind of interesting to see that a four-year-old had already
internalized the
mummy. So that's the obvious sort of route in of why we're so obsessed. But I suppose we need to... You're an Egyptologist. Let's do some Egypt, or rather, let's do some Egyptian culture. When are we talking about for the practice of mummification in terms of the history of Egypt? So we talk about Egyptian civilization being 3,200 years long, give or take. You've got the pre-dynastic era, obviously, the very, very early days. But if we're talking a Bronze Age, going back 5,200 years up to 2,000 years ago, Cleopatra, when does mummification show up? When does it stop?
Well, it's something we explored in Totally Chaotic History, actually. The arrival of mummification isn't heralded with trumpets and now we're doing this.
Introducing mummification.
Boom. It's not like that. It would look great and funny on a page if it was. But cultural practices around death go back a long way. Physical anthropologists will tell you that. So the treatment of the body, and I really emphasize this, there is the treatment of the body, which is to mark out the deceased as special, as somehow elevated and beyond living people. That idea is fundamental, it seems, from the earliest contexts. So, wrapping the body in linen as a shroud, or even, we've got early evidence of wrapping in matting, or even like a leather bag. There are early pre-dynastic examples of bodies wrapped in leather. This happens before the pre-dynastic period, which ends, according to Egyptologists, around 3100 BC. So before that point, there is something approaching the special treatment of the body. If by mummification you mean covering in black goo or some other fragrant resin, which is a sign of divinity, well, that happens for centuries before the pre-dynastic period ends as well. So it spans a huge period. It's impossible to say when it starts. It says much more about historians' own desire to classify and mark out periods and say, now this is the thing that we're obsessed about and this is when it begins. It does seem to die out, the special treatment of the body like that, in Christian times.
Right, okay.
So you're talking 4th, 5th, 6th century AD.
So late antiquity,
yeah.
When post sort of Constantine, post, yeah. You know, obviously Egypt by this point is part of the Roman world and then later on part of the Arab world. It's we're way beyond the ancient world in some ways.
Yeah.
But it's interesting you said it starts before the dynastic period.
Oh, sure.
Which already that's a long way away. But if it's predating that, then this feels pre-Egyptian in some ways.
Yes, and the idea we have that mummification is very Egyptian, a lot of Egyptology is back to front. We confuse cause with effect.
Yeah.
So the traditional story that I was taught at school was that the Egyptians start building tombs, right?
Yeah.
So initially there are simple burials in the desert and then they get more ambitious and they build big tombs. And because the tombs are big, it stops the drying, dehydrating sand from coming into contact with the body. So it stops preservation. So right. They have to invent artificial preservation.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Okay, so the argument would be, by putting a tomb in made of stone, The body starts to decay and rot because you're no longer getting that arid, dry Saharan heat.
Exactly.
Which then preserves the body. That's the standard argument.
Yeah. But that's based on people observing.
Myth busted. Yeah.
The effects of different kinds of environments that I don't think necessarily would have occurred to the ancient Egyptians. So I think special treatment of the body with the aim of changing the status of the deceased.
We'll get back to that
later. We'll come back to this.
But that was an interesting question. So we had that question from Robert Keynes and Ron Porteous and several other people, because a lot of people think of mummification as a quintessential Egyptian thing.
Yes.
And actually, when we wrote our book, we did say, actually, it is quintessential. It's there at the beginning, it's there at the end. But there are changes through that time. There are shifts in how it's done. There are shifts in what they might look like now. So it's not like a sort of set in stone, this is what we do from day one. But it really is a long-standing tradition.
It may be, Greg, that lots of cultures have these attitudes.
Sure.
They are simply masked by the fact the conditions in the other cultures don't favor preservation. So the ancient Egyptians, at the same time as they have these special treatments of the deceased, they are interested in monumental tomb building and furnishing the deceased with objects, right? So these things are the things that end up in museums and belong to this tiny percentage of the rich people, and we're all obsessed with the rich people. They influence our perceptions and draw attention, I think, to the fact of the body being dehydrated and preserved.
Okay.
But I don't think preservation in the first instance was the objective. It's the effect of some other rituals, but it wasn't the aim from the outset.
So who's being mummified then? Because I think it's easy to assume this is the default. What you know, grandpa has passed away, it's all very sad, let's pop him down to the funeral parlour and get him mummified. Is that happening universally to everyone, or is mummification an elite status thing that we have decided is a standard Egyptian thing because the posh ones have survived and we've popped them in our museums?
So, I mean, the Egyptian population, Egyptologists can't agree what size it was at what point, but let's say time of Ramses the Great.
Yeah.
1200 BC, it's a million people, for argument's sake.
Okay, sure.
And of those million, I think the people who would have access to mummification, which is expensive because the oils are imported, the resins, the linen, the cloth made of flax, that's expensive too. You don't pop down to Marks and Spencer's and buy yourself a shirt. You need to know someone with a loom, and you reuse clothing a lot more. So to be wrapped up in the case of one mummified gentleman in, 400 yards of cloth.
One person, 400 yards.
Looks like the Michelin man.
Yeah.
That is expensive, and it's a status symbol. It's also a way of imparting divinity, the status of a god, because God's images are wrapped and shrouded. And in Egyptology, we often say they are mummiform. Haha, no. What if it's the other way around? Mummified bodies are in the shape of gods. It's not that gods are in the shape of the dead.
So this is your big fun.
This is my thing.
This is your, I'm trying to think of the fun way of phrasing it. This is what you wanted to achieve when we sat down to write a book together. You wanted to get across the fact that there is now an ascendant theory that mummification wasn't about preservation, but was about transformation.
Yes.
And that this ritual was about turning you into the divine. You become godified, deified.
Yes.
By the funeral parlour doing all this work for you.
Yes.
Now that in itself is fascinating, but does that therefore mean that most people weren't turned into gods? Then if mummification is an elite status thing and it costs an awful fortune for 400 yards of linen, does that mean most people don't get to become a gods?
I strongly suspect that the transformation element, if we allow that transformation can be effected by a ritual, by something spoken, then maybe I suspect the majority of people, and I'm talking 90%, of the population, who were mostly farmers in ancient times in Egypt, would probably have observed something like modern Islamic practice, where you get buried within 24 hours, you are wrapped quite simply, but the rituals, the prayers, the incantations that are done to accompany a funeral are enough to transform you into the afterlife, or at least to exist with the gods, if not as a god yourself. So if we step back from this obsession about preserving the flesh and looking like grandpa just fell asleep. Yes, some mummified people looked like, when they were discovered, they'd fallen asleep. But that may not have been the intention. That's simply the effect of the use of oils and the conditions they were buried in.
So you would make the case that people are being treated according to status and class?
Yes.
So, okay, so let's talk about the elite ones then. So how much work is it to prepare a mummy for the afterlife? Assuming it's for the afterlife, assuming that's the purpose of becoming a god, but how much work, how many days labor, how much cash are we, there's no cash in ancient Egypt. How many onions and garlic bulbs are you investing to get someone ready for death?
17 sheep, maybe. Ooh. 17 sheep's worth is a decent coffin. 17 sheep.
So you're trading 17 sheep.
Yeah.
One flock.
So think about what you could do with 17 sheep.
That's a weird thing to ask. I'm now imagining like a motorcycle pyramid team with sheep on motorbikes. But okay, so you're a lot of goods.
And I'm just talking about, half decent wooden coffin, because wood is not in abundance in Egypt. The wood is actually
It's a desert, right? Yeah. So there's not going to be much wood growing.
Yeah. So mummification, get the linen to get the requisite oils and the natron, which is this sodium compound.
So that's salt.
Which is purifying the body, dehydrating it, turning it into a divine being, divine effigy. All of this really can only be done by the top.
Yeah.
5% of society. It's expensive. It takes 70 days.
70.
70.
Right. So 17 sheep and 70 days.
Yes. but the reason we know this is not because the ancient Egyptians write it down. They're actually quite cagey about what they say about mummification. It's a taboo to record information about it. It was the nosy Greeks who come along, people like Herodotus and Diodorus Siculus, who say, what are you doing there? And then they record these outsiders with the morbid fascination that we still have, say, oh, you look like you're salting fish. And
that
idea of preserving food to use later is applied to the human body, which has been transformed, I would argue, into something divine. And it requires a bit of mental gymnastics, which is not always a bad thing. And I always say to students in Manchester, if you try and unthink all the assumptions we have, which have been loaded onto ancient Egyptian things and people, if you try and unthink those, maybe you get closer to what the ancient Egyptians were thinking.
So mummification is universal in that everyone is treated after death in a basic way, but actually the mummification that we think of is not universal. It's high status, elites, 70 days worth of labor, priests, the funeral parlor, prayer ritual, all sorts of fabrics, lovely smelly incense. It's a big to-do.
It's a big to-do. Although having said that, okay, you need to be in the elite, there is evidence from the later periods of pharaonic history into what we call the Greco-Roman period. So Egypt under the Ptolemies, Cleopatra VII, and Egypt under the Roman Empire. There's evidence from texts, because texts become more voluminous and verbose, that talk about people clubbing together. So if you were really popular, but you didn't have much money, maybe your mates could club together and pay for your mummification.
We sort of get that now these days, right? Sometimes people...
Crowdsourcing.
That's interesting. So there is a class status here, which is quite interesting. And the mummies themselves... That sort of process, is there a local funeral parlor in every town? Do you have to travel? Do you have to put the body on the back of a boat and take it down the Nile?
There must be specialists in every local area. But in one town that we know lots about, the community of Deir el-Medina, these are the people who worked in the Valley of the Kings building tombs between around 1500 and 1100 BC. They are the best known community because they write the most stuff down. And because they're involved in an important project, building the royal tomb, the pharaoh's underground burial apartment, they get monitored by the state. And so there's lots of documents. And in it, they have to justify their absences. And in lists of absences, you can say, oh, I was getting drunk with the gods at a festival. Or you can say, I was mummifying my mother.
Right. Okay.
So that rather suggests that the actual business of preparing a corpse could have been shared by fairly regular people.
Yeah, okay. And also that tells us people need a note off to get off work, and it's like getting a doctor's note or saying, I'm really sorry, I'm on compassionate leave because there's been a death in the family. I'm mummifying my mother. I'm mummifying my mummy.
But based on other evidence, hieroglyphic texts which recount people's titles, although, again, the evidence is quite cagey about this taboo subject of mummification, because it's a sacred rite. It's not that they're squeamish about it. It's just there's some things you don't talk about or you don't depict explicitly. So amongst those texts, it does seem that there are a group of ritual specialists who are trained in the treating of the body, embalmers, you might call them today.
George Haig has asked via Facebook, were there any laws or legal restrictions for mummification? So I think that's an interesting question as to whether there is some sort of supervisory body or whether there's some sort of checking.
Regulating guild of embalmers.
These are dead bodies, and this is a hygiene and health question as well, and a religious and ethical one. So do we know of any official rules and laws about the process?
As I say, later into the Greco-Roman period, there is more evidence of these kind of guilds, but they're not really guilds of embalmers dealing with the process of mummification and evisceration and dehydration. There are the people who do the rituals for the dead. And that's a very lucrative business.
Yeah.
Because if you've got 10 mummies you're looking after and I've only got 5, the families are paying you to do it. So maybe I could trade with you and I could have the rights to a couple of your mummies. So that gets regulated.
Wow.
That gets kind of internally regulated by a kind of social convention.
Okay.
But there isn't, that I know of, there's no real legal framework as we would understand it in pharaonic Egypt.
Sure, there's not a bureaucracy saying,
it's not like that.
Fill in this form.
And we think, because we see the pyramids, oh, this must have been a very deeply bureaucratic system. That's kind of a back projection of modern ideas of the nation state and bureaucracy onto the ancient past. So for mummification, no, I don't think there were specific legal restrictions on its performance. And we'll get on to the question perhaps of animal mummies.
Yeah.
There is a question about, you have to do things in a special way for animal mummies, not to potentially hoodwink people.
Ah, interesting. Okay, we'll come back to that. I want to read this question simply because I love the name. Holly Dolly Doodah has asked, was the linen they were wrapped in significant? And you've already mentioned that 400 yards of it, that's significant in its own right.
Yeah.
Why linen? Is it expensive? Is it clean? What is it about linen that makes it, you know, as opposed to cotton or silks or?
Well, as far as we know, they didn't know about silk, maybe later through importation in the Silk Road.
Yeah.
They don't know about cotton. So we have obviously cotton bed sheets from Egypt now. No cotton.
Gotcha. Okay.
There's limited evidence of the use of wool, but wool is thought to be unclean. So linen from flax is the clean stuff. And it is associated not just with cleanness, but purity and godly purity. So you gods are said to be wrapped up in linen.
Right.
When the king is performing rituals, he's often shown shrouded up. So it's a sign that you've got conspicuous consumption of linen if you're wrapped up in linen.
Yeah.
So I think in answer to that particular question, there is evidence that in rituals in temples where you'd be performing the rites on a statue of a god that was maybe made of gold or sheathed with precious metal, the clothing the gods are dressed up in, that's special and it's like magnetized by divine energy. So the best linen you can have for mummification is that which has come from the temple, which was used previously to shroud a god statue.
Okay.
We have evidence for that.
So it's a recycling, but quite a fancy.
But that's fancy. That's top end.
Yeah.
Less top end. You might be a sailor and you might have the sail of your ship.
Right, okay.
The sail of your boat. We've found evidence of that. Here in Manchester Museum, I met a researcher from France today, a French colleague, who was coming to examine a tunic we have discovered in the 1970s, folded, carefully wrapped into the mummified body of an adolescent, probably worn by that person, with all the seams, all the stitching there, probably a prized garment that once they died, it was simply left over. Bed sheets are used as well. So it is possible the linen was significant. Some of the bandages that have been discovered in unwrapped mummies have little marks from where they've been laundered or from where they've come from a temple or a very wealthy estate.
But they're never stolen from a hotel.
If the Egyptians had hotel towels, maybe they would have stolen them.
We've had a few questions, and these are obvious questions. These are the questions that kids always want to ask me, and certainly we address this on Horrible Histories, about the physicality of the process and what happens to the body and the organs and the brain. And I know this is an area that you're not super-duper keen on focusing on, so I wanted to sort of open that for you to handle however you like. But obviously, the organs come out.
Sometimes.
Right.
The organs come out. This, Greg, comes from a pre-Victorian obsession from particularly the mid-1700s.
Yeah.
An obsession from modern surgeons, anatomists, people trying to understand the human body, who were also the first people to unwrap Egyptian mummies because they were arriving in Europe.
Yeah.
So the surgeons, as they might have called themselves, were trying to stop these upstart undertakers from taking over their business, which was previously the jobs of the surgeons. So there's an interest in finding out about ancient Egyptian practice. And what happens is these surgeons, who are also interested in preserving the body, because potentially for the elite, you have to move bodies about, you know, about these things. That learning, that modern learning, is projected back onto the past. Also, nowadays, we are morbidly fascinated about the gory, gooey, squelchy bits.
And kids love that.
And kids
When I did Horrible Histories, that's what kids want to know. They want to know about the brain coming out through the nose and the canopic jars.
And it happens in some cases, because remember, we have thousands of mummified bodies that have been studied from all kinds of different periods. So over a 2,000-year period, we have thousands of bodies. Regional variations happened. Variations over time happened. But the classic New Kingdom treatment of the body of an elite person like a king would involve sticking a metal hook up the nose, swizzling it about a bit, spooning the brain matter out,
right,
and then cutting a slit in the side and removing the internal organs. For treatment separately, for dehydration, for purification, for putting occasionally in things called canopic jars, which are in fact images of gods.
Yeah.
So you're activating images of gods that are going to protect you.
And they're four little, I mean, I think we did a joke in our book about them being like a boy band, but they are these four gods.
The four sons of Horus.
That's right, who've each got a kind of organ they look after. But the heart doesn't come out.
Often the heart does come out. We've become obsessed with this idea of the heart being left in the chest for the final judgment, where conceptually it's weighed against a feather, the feather of truth and justice, the feather of Ma'at. And if your heart weighs the same as the feather, you're good to go. You can come into the afterlife. If it's heavy with the bad things you've done,
it gets chucked to Amit the Devourer, the big old monster who eats your heart, and you vanish, puff of smoke. So you're saying actually the heart staying in the chest is a bit of a pop culture myth?
Yeah. A colleague here at Manchester University examined CT scans and often found the heart was there.
Ooh, you heard it here first.
Or it wasn't there. So
right, so
it was removed sometimes where it was expected and it was still in when maybe.
So the brain always comes out, but the heart...
The brain doesn't always come out either.
Oh, yeah, look at you with all your kind of disruptive...
One of the great simplifications, and it's still written about in kind of standard Egyptology books, is that the quality of mummification degrades and they just give up on removing the organs and the brain and they just slosh in a bit of black goo and the jobs are good. No one thinks they're doing a bad job here. Yeah. The black goo is transforming you into Osiris, the god of rebirth. And so just because we make a judgment, we have these kind of cultural evolutionary scales where we say, this is good, this is better, this is rubbish. I don't think it was like that. The complexity of culture is not easy to simplify.
I mean, Max Quigley on Instagram has asked, how does the technology and practice of mummification evolve over the centuries? And you're saying there are changes in some regards and there aren't in others, right?
It doesn't evolve. I think that's the wrong way to think about it. It changes over time, depending on region.
Yeah.
The objective, the end...
Depending on region. So there are regional variations within Egypt. So there's not a standardized Egypt way. You've got Upper Egypt in the south and Lower Egypt in the north, which is very confusing.
Yes.
But there's also just, you know, which city you're in might determine it, or which god you believe is your favorite god.
Potentially, yeah, that could have an influence. But this idea of things evolving and then getting rubbish, often the decline in quality of mummification, so-called, is explained by foreign influence in Egypt,
right,
which is kind of problematic way of looking at human society. No, I think the realities are much more complex, and it would, I think, depend on a case-by-case basis. So you might have someone who's not very well off, who is treated in a particular way. You might have a king whose body, to us, is not very well preserved. But still, the rituals were observed as the ancient Egyptians would have thought of.
You've talked about the black goo, which sounds very, I don't know, very Star Trek. the black goo. That's where we get the word mummy.
Yes, ultimately. So the black goo applied to mummified bodies has been confused with a different kind of black bitumen, which is known from the area of modern Iran, ancient Persia, which was thought to have healing curative properties. And that is called mumia in Persian Arabic.
Yeah.
So the one type of naturally occurring black goo has been confused with an artificially created black goo for applying to mummified bodies. So the word mummy comes from a misunderstanding.
That's amazing, isn't it? The word mummy, which is a word that my 4-year-old knows.
Universal.
Everyone listening to this now knows the word mummy. We all know what it is. it's a misunderstanding, a mistranslation of a type of what they thought was melissa, but actually was more of a sort of tar, like a resin, road surfacing tarmac.
Yes, and because the word mummy is applied in that Hollywood sense, it does objectify human remains. And so some museums are less comfortable about using it. And here in Manchester Museum, we would now describe, were we to display mummified human remains, as the mummified body of a person.
Well, that's one of the questions we have here. I don't think there's a name associated, but one of the questions we've had is that there are big debates surrounding the display of mummies in museums. And I think the question has asked, how has the opinion changed over the last century or so? But actually, seeing as I have you right now, how has the practice here in your museum changed over the past 20 odd years or so? Have you put in place different ethical policies? Do you discuss this? Like,
I think we discuss it much more now, and with colleagues, we have a new ancestral remains policy. Mm-hmm. But we learned a lot from the exhibition Golden Mummies of Egypt, which was seen by a million people, and which posed some of these questions about the ethics, not just of displaying human and ancestral remains, but of discussing them and of interpreting them, use of CT scans and x-rays.
Yeah.
So in one way, I think discussion has intensified in museums, but also I've read accounts from 200 years ago and the debates were the same. You should display these for science.
Yeah.
People are curious. We can learn things about our fellow human beings.
Sure.
Or you shouldn't absolutely do this. This is totally wrong.
Yeah.
And so this idea that it is a debate simply of the now is wrong. It has been happening for well over 100 years.
That's really interesting. So you mentioned earlier the sort of surgeons opening up the bodies. There's a very famous one, Thomas Pettigrew, I think, who was renowned for these kind of unwrapping parties, I think they were, where he'd get a big crowd in and he would unwrap the linen and have a little look and see what he'd got inside there. This idea of it's all in the name of science, it's all educational, you know, we need to demystify the dead and you know, stop being so squeamish. But at the same time, these people who died long ago didn't give permission.
No, indeed.
It's not, it's not donating your body to medical science. These are ancient Egyptians. They didn't know that we would be digging them up and putting them in museums. So there are really interesting ethical questions. But there's also, you're saying that in the 19th century, people were already arguing about whether it's right and wrong.
Yeah, there were big cultural debates and, you know, publications, periodicals of the time, arguing both extremities of the argument, but also bits in the middle. It's also worth bearing in mind, in some ways, from some perspectives, the mummified dead that ended up in museums were the lucky ones, because we have lots of evidence of hundreds, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of mummified bodies being used as fuel on railways.
Oh, this is interesting. So Siobhan Nevin from Facebook has said, is it true they were used as fertilizer in the 19th century?
So we know of the pulping of bandages for paper.
Right.
The fuel for railways. The grinding up of mummified flesh for use as medicine.
Yes.
And as paint.
As paint as well, okay.
As paint.
That's one of the questions I've got here, yeah, okay.
Yeah, you know, some of those pre-Raphaelite paintings, Burne Jones is using mummified flesh to create his brown colours.
Right.
So
it's a mummy brown.
Mummy brown is made of mummified flesh. So lots of terrible things could happen to the mummified dead. Fertilizer, a particular source of fertilizer, was not mummified human beings, but mummified animals. So there's an account from 1890 of 180,000 cat mummies docking in Liverpool, my adopted native city, and being sold at the dockside to farmers.
And that's a weird...
Yeah.
That's just a weird thing to even imagine, isn't it? This sort of crate full of mummified cats from the ancient world.
And amongst the auction, they were auctioned off on the dockside. Amongst the farmers, there were some curators who saved some examples for museums, but most of them are between where we are now in Manchester and back in Liverpool. That train line, one of the first train lines in the world, is either side of it, mummified cats.
That's fascinating and grim and weird and, you know, also, sorry, I'm trying to work out how to go from there, to pivot. I think we need to talk about animal mummies because you've already alluded to them earlier. We've now got onto them in the 19th century being used for industrial purposes. Mm. But actually that begs the question of, hang on a second, why were Egyptians mummifying cats in the first place? And I know one of your bugbears, not a bugbear, that's not fair, one of your points you always try to stress to me, to kids when they ask questions, is that Egyptians didn't just worship cats. They were much more just worshipping of all animals. But for some reason, cats seem to have dominated our understanding.
Yes, I mean, I think in the ancient Egyptian worldview, animals stand between human beings and gods, all animals. Mm-hmm. Cats, cows, crocodiles, dogs, fish, scarab, dung beetles.
Yeah.
Anything that moves can be killed and mummified.
That's such
and anything that is not human can be an avatar of the divine.
Yeah.
So gods are more than human beings. So how do you depict this idea of godliness, divinity? One way is to show a man with a falcon's head or a woman with a cow's head.
Yeah, Hathor or Horus. Yeah.
So you have this idea, and that is very quintessentially Egyptian. So it's not just cats. But the allied idea that the ancient Egyptians are somehow animal lovers has crept in.
Yeah.
Through our Western notion.
Well, when we say animal lover, we imagine someone who's got 15 cats and sheep and goats in the garden, and they spend the time looking after them and cuddling them. Whereas in Egypt, there's a lot more murder.
Yes. The concept, even the concept of a household pet is highly, you know, culturally contingent. Not all cultures do it now. It's very specific. And so there's this nice idea of the ancient Egyptians all having their pet cats. The actual practical evidence of ancient Egyptians who had a pet dog, pet hound, a pet cat is infinitesimally small. Much more likely, as you've already alluded to, Greg, was that not just thousands, not just tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, but millions of animals were raised for slaughter. And they were offered as images of gods to the gods themselves. So you go along to a temple. You want your prayer answered, or you're grateful for the perception that your prayer has previously been answered. So you give the god an image of themselves, because the gods are quite self-centered and just want an image of themselves.
A selfie of me? Oh, you shouldn't have.
Oh, thanks. And you put your name on it so they know.
Yeah.
They know it was you.
This is from
that's,
me. Yeah.
That's given it to them. So you can either give a bronze statuette of that god in animal form, part animal form, or you can give a mummified example, mummified specimen of their favorite species.
Okay.
So this happens, I'm not exaggerating when I say there's an estimate of maybe 70 million.
Oh my word.
Of these. Over periods of several centuries.
Sure.
But still, it's a huge number.
That's an industrial quantity of cat murder.
So remember, if we're thinking about human mummification, it's not about preserving the mummies. It's not so Kitty can go and exist in the afterlife with their owner.
Yeah.
That is a modern Western fantasy. It is so that there is some divine material being given to the gods. So colleagues here at the University of Manchester examined lots of animal mummies and found that only a third of animal mummies contain the full animal.
Oh, right.
Another third contain part of the animal, and the final third don't contain any animal matter at all.
They're just sort of animal-adjacent, sort of like...
Animal-adjacent. Mud, reeds, eggshell.
Bit of nature.
A bit of nature.
Yeah.
But we are very judgmental of this, and this leads me back to a point about regulation. So we have a text from the wonderful archaeological site, huge mummified zoo of a site called the Sacred Animal Necropolis at Saqqara, where I did my fieldwork as an Egyptology student. And underground, there were literally miles and miles and miles of catacombs filled with animal mummies. And there were also texts discovered, one of which said, you know, it is a rule of one god, one pot. So these are often put in clay pots. So the interpretation is you should put one mummified falcon bird in one pot.
Right.
And don't try and hoodwink pilgrims. Because if you go along and expect to buy a mummified cat, you want to know that there was in fact a mummified cat there. That doesn't take account of the fact that bits of animal bits of cat, bits of jackal, bits of crocodile, they are imbued with magical divine significance as well.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're wrapped up isn't to preserve them. It's simply to make them a suitable offering for the gods. It's to make them divine so the gods will accept them.
So Nicholas Surges on Facebook asked what's quite an interesting question, which I think you might now rebut. But he said, how did the Egyptians reconcile the mass production of cat mummies with the fact that the cat was a sacred animal?
Well, Nicholas, that's an excellent question. You cannot reconcile them, really, from a modern point of view. So sure. We think it's, oh, this is a total contradiction.
Yeah.
No. Animals are divine. They all have the divine natures in a way. It is okay to give some divine material back to a god. So you slaughter those kitties. Kittens are reared for slaughter, and Bastet, the cat goddess, yeah, is perfectly happy to accept them. We have to get rid of our modern Western sentimental vision of, oh, kitties are so cute.
Because Bubastis is a city with loads of cat corpses in it, right?
Yeah, there's accounts, Herodotus and others talk about, although Herodotus's total understanding of Egyptian culture might be a wee bit iffy. He describes, you know, if a cat dies anywhere in Egypt, you've got to send it to the city of Bastet called Bubastis. He also says that if your cat dies, you have to shave off your eyebrows.
Yeah.
Which is my favorite mummy fact.
Yeah. The idea that you're in mourning, off come the eyebrows.
Yeah, oh, I can tell. Oh, I'm sorry. You lost your pet cat.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But that is a Greek person looking in and misunderstanding Egyptian practice.
Or not even misunderstanding, but pointing and laughing and going, yes, those weirdos over there.
Yes, exactly. Deliberately misunderstanding or parodying. Yes.
Yeah. So the cats aren't divine, but they are the route to the divine.
Exactly. They're messengers in a way.
Sure.
They are gifts for the gods.
I've got bad news. You needed to take a message to the god. Unfortunately, first, I'm going to have to.
You're not going to get out of this.
Yeah. You've bust quite a lot of few myths already on this one, and we've sort of, you know, bounced all over the place. What's quite interesting, I suppose, is that we know so much about this through archaeology. Do we know anything through texts and documents? Do we, you know, the Book of the Dead is a sort of famous text we have. Do we have anything that tells us what Egyptians believed? Because I think quite a lot of what you're communicating to me sounds like it's been, you've built that picture through archaeology and best practice and figuring out context. But do we have any like actual words that tell us stuff?
Well, Greg, we're as I've already alluded to, we're laboring under these Victorian Georgian concepts, which we've been lumbered with. So Egyptology particularly is a product of these quite old-fashioned ideas, and it's difficult to shift them. Yes, we try and look at the archaeology critically, but that's difficult because archaeology is revealing partial material. It's not presenting us with simple facts. Texts, there are some texts, but they're very recondite, they're very restricted in what they're allowed to say. So you wouldn't expect a full treatment of, here is what every ancient Egyptian believed. They don't even talk about believing, they talk about knowing.
Sure, because it's not faith, it's knowledge.
Knowledge, yeah. It's special knowledge. So there's one text that talks about the proper mummification of a bull. The Apis bull, the sacred Apis bull.
The kind of fortune-telling bull, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's thought to be an avatar of the god Ptah, a god associated with the capital city of Memphis. And so when it dies, like the Dalai Lama, it's allowed to live its natural life, and then a new one has to be found based on special markings. But when the bull dies, the document called the embalming ritual, that's the modern name of the text, describes how you put on the bandages, what ritual recitations you make, what amulets you might use, what kind of religious ritual stuff you do. Mm. It doesn't describe the cutting open and the drying out and the things that we might want to know about. So the texts are, as I said before, cagey. So you have to infer, and that's where the problem comes.
Sure. So let's talk, I think, finally about mummies in pop culture, because, you know, you're an Egyptologist, you're a curator, you're dealing with the physical remains and how we should think about them. But I'm much more interested, well, not much more, that's not true. I am interested in how popular culture shapes how we think about the past. And we started at the very beginning by talking about mummies as sort of gothic horror images.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask, I think that we have a question here from Monica Del Val, who says, when did we first see mummies become a part of pop culture? I'd make the case that the discovery of Tutankhamun is enormously important in that. Well, you get Tutmania.
Yeah.
And about 10 years later, because that's 1922, about 10 years later, the mummy gets added to the kind of horror canon with the Universal.
1932, yeah.
Yeah, the Universal Picture movies where they're doing Frankenstein and vampires and Dracula, and they add in the mummy monsters. So within 10 years of a discovery of the great pharaoh, and then you get the kind of nonsense curse idea. Mm-hmm. So I'd say the 20s and 30s is really important. Do you want to go earlier than me? Do you want to go later? Do you want to?
I think, so mummies are sexy before 1922.
It's all the bandages. It's all the unwrapping.
Because, and you've raised an important point, it happens before Tutankhamun, but because Tutankhamun is associated because of the death of Lord Carnarvon, the sponsor of Howard Carter, with the revenge of the pharaoh.
Yeah.
This is a very extreme version of this kind of colonial guilt, which is building up for decades before then. So I think even in the mid-1800s, you're getting this idea of the mummy as a kind of sexy threat, usually female. She might be trying to seduce the male archaeologist. But then after the Tutankhamun interlude around that time, you get mummies as being shuffling, reanimated.
Yeah, it's proper zombie stuff.
Yeah, polluting,
yeah,
dirty, yeah, vengeful creatures.
Yeah, because they are an object of horror because they are bodies and they're covered in bandages. So there's a sort of odd, they're not quite ghosts, but they're not quite real, but they are real because they're bodies. As you said before, there's an uncanny valley element kicking in. But it's funny, you've used the word sexy and you've used the word sort of, you know, almost a sort of eroticism to the idea. But mummies as a kind of mysterious conundrum, I don't know, it feels like there's a lot of stuff going on there. So I'm just curious as to whether over the 20th century you've seen any. I mean, actually, we've got a question here. Let me do this. Have you seen any portrayals of mummies that you enjoyed personally or you thought were well done or, you know, you think that they are well handled in pop culture?
Well, there's so many responses here. We could talk for another hour about the mummy in pop culture. I mean, there's a story, one of my favourites, because it's so hair-raising, by Bram Stoker, The Jewel of Seven Stars, published in 1903, which is inspired by real historical characters and real material in museums. And that has this time-travelling sorceress queen called Tara, who just wants to wreak vengeance on these Edwardian people. And it's also partly a kind of explication or apology for colonial violence. So I think Orientalism has a lot to answer for this idea of the ancient Egyptians as being very other, being threatening on some level, but being very alluring. So this is where this idea, especially of the female temptress who's trying to, she represents the Orient and she's trying to tempt the ostensibly heterosexual upper middle class.
For listeners, Campbell did a sort of saucy dance there. That was very enjoyable.
So any of these recreations are based on the interests and the prejudices of the people who create the material, right? My favourite, if you had to put a gun to my head, was something I saw when I was much too young, but my parents showed me, the 1959 Hammer horror, The Mummy, which has a shuffling, staggering Christopher Lee in the avenging mummy role. But there's a beautiful scene, throwback, you know, kind of to ancient Egypt, of the princess he's in love with, Ananka, being mummified. And it looks like she's just being lowered into a bubble bath. And this idea, it's interesting because colleagues have examined, you know, the possibility that the natron I talked about before, this purifying material, salt, wasn't applied dry. It could have been applied as a solution.
Yeah, okay.
And it may have had symbolic meaning. And it's funny that pop culture, the thing I really want to emphasize is pop culture reflects academic thought, right?
Yeah.
But academic thought sometimes draws on pop culture. So museums do what the movies are doing. It's not always the other way around.
Okay, so we can expect to see Rachel Weisz and Brendan Fraser in here.
Oh,
soon.
I can't wait.
So a final thought then. How many mummies have we got in total? Do we know? Have we counted up how many there are in museum collections? That must be a vast number.
I mean, as I said, sadly, tens of thousands will have been burnt or crushed up and consumed. Which, as you might expect, you know, mummy cannibalism is not an ideal treatment for syphilis, as was thought in the 1600s. But surviving in museums now, I would say maybe there are a couple of hundred in British museums.
Right, okay.
And including Europe and America and Egypt itself, there must be several thousand. Yeah.
Yeah.
But lots remain in situ. They're known about, they've just not been excavated. But I think museums in the last 300 years, since the invention of the museum, have created this demand and this expectation and this normality about seeing, whether you agree with it or not, the expectation exists now that you can go and have that experience. Trying to think why we are interested in the mummified dead is a far more interesting question to me than how did they do the mummification?
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating and lovely point to leave it at. So, Dr. Campbell Price, thank you very much for all your mummy facts.
Thank you, Greg.
And if people want to read our kids' book, they can. It's called Totally Chaotic History. Ancient Egypt Gets Unruly. It's for kids aged 8 to 12, but I think that's basically it. So thank you so much, Campbell.
Thanks, Greg.
That was Dr. Campbell Price, curator of Egypt and Sudan at the Manchester Museum, speaking to the public historian and broadcaster, Greg Jenner. Their book is Totally Chaotic History, Ancient Egypt Gets Unruly, which is out now, published by Walker Books. And Greg's podcast, You're Dead to Me, is available now on BBC Sounds. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.